From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Today I'm joined by University of Nebraska political scientist Jonathan Benjamin Alvarado. We'll talk about the legacy of Fidel Castro, who died a week ago today.
People's entire livelihood, their way of life, was removed from them forcefully as a consequence of his coming to power. But on the other hand, there's a real sense of loss because for so many of them, he's all that they know.
Then I'll talk with Ned Breslin. He spent more than 20 years living and working in Africa and says he spent 70% of his time fixing broken infrastructure.
It's not just about putting in a hand pump and saying, voila, there you go. It's about building up supply chains around it. It's about building up financial responsibility and management around it. And it's about getting government to do its job.
But first, this hour's news.
This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Jonathan Benjamin Alvarado, let's talk about what's happened in Cuba. A week ago, Fidel Castro, longtime serving revolutionary and longtime serving president until about 2008, I believe. Mm-hmm. He gave up power in 2006, but his brother became president in 2008. But he passed away. Mm-hmm. And so this is an interesting change in development for Cuba, clearly. And it seems like the legacies that Castro has left are a bit mixed, right? So the healthcare and education part. He did quite a lot, mm-hmm. but economic conditions and infrastructure issues, not mm-hmm. so great. So tell mm-hmm. us, what do you think are the most important legacies that Castro left, and what are we to expect in the near future?
Well, I guess for me, the biggest thing that I take away from the whole experience is that he was really the seminal character in the formulation of the Cuban nation. Prior to Fidel Castro coming to power, Cuba had been under the control of the Spaniards for hundreds of years and then really dominated by the United States from the turn of the 20th century till 1959. And there's this abrupt rupture that occurs when he comes to power. And I think that's what a lot of people have been struggling with, especially if we look at, you know, the legacies of American power in the Caribbean and Central and South America, that we have been the dominant force. And so for Castro to be able to resist that for so long, it really has accorded him, you know, this legendary status throughout the developing world, that he was able to stick a finger in the eye of the American giant for all those years. And I think it's ironic that at the very end of his life, he was a feeble character doddering around in sweats and very, you know, making rare, if any, public appearances at all. But that'll be the largest legacy of all. I mean, granted, he was not a saint by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that if we look at, you know, the fact is that he came to power through violence and had to govern through violence. It necessitated the complete destruction of the middle and upper classes of Cuba in order for him to institute the revolution and the revolutionary plans. That being said, yes, we could say that the education and healthcare and the arts were great accomplishments for Cuba, but you have to balance that against the historical record of the oppression of the Cuban people, his internationalist kind of ventures, you know, in the developing world. And at the end of the day, that Cuba has still so much work to do in order to really be a fully functioning, integrated nation in the world, that history is going to have a very interesting perspective on what he's been able to do.
So what has the reaction largely been for Cubans? I mean, you're about to go to Cuba again mm-hmm. for, I think, the 30th time. You've
Correct.
Traveled to Cuba many, many times. And so what has the reaction been to Castro's passing, not only among Cubans in Cuba, but mm-hmm. the many, many Cubans that live in the United States?
Well, I think for a lot of Cubans here, they're in the United States, there's a sense of relief that they've finally ridded themselves of this evil entity in their lives. I mean, I'm not going to pretend that there wasn't an impact in Cuba. The fact is you have to understand that people's entire livelihood, their way of life, was removed from them forcefully and they were forced to leave anything that they had ever known, and in some cases, losing family members as a consequence of his coming to power. And so for him to depart the scene, I'm sure it brought great joy to them to know that he was gone. But on the other hand, what I'm hearing from people that I've been talking with and communicating with in Cuba, there's a real sense of loss, because for so many of them, he's all that they know. None of them have lived long enough to know what it was like prior to the revolution. And I think that there's going to be a great vacuum in terms of the symbolic power that he, provided for the Cuban people. And it was a cult of personality. The irony of it is, if you've traveled to Cuba, there were never any statues of Fidel Castro, not like you saw with Saddam Hussein or the Kims or anything like that. He would always use Che Guevara or Jose Marti to be those cultural icons. But, his slogans were everywhere. And the influence that he had over Cuban society and people's loyalty to the principles of the revolution were very intense. And so that's going to be a large loss for those people.
Well, we will definitely, as you mentioned, be looking at how things might change and develop in Cuba in the coming days, months, and years. So thank you so much, Jonathan, for your insight.
Thank you.
And we'll hear much more about the future of Cuba in a post-Fidel Castro world and how the thawing relationship with the United States could change under President-elect Donald Trump on next week's show. We'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation. Leave your comments at kgou.org or reach out to us on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Corlott. On Wednesday, the Tennyson Center in Colorado announced our next guest would become its new CEO. Ned Breslin will lead the organization that provides services to survivors of child abuse and neglect and others with significant mental health issues. When we spoke in September, he was a top executive at the Wounded Warrior Project, but we primarily focused on the nearly 10 years he spent at the non-governmental organization Water for People. Ned Breslin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. So you've had this long history as a social entrepreneur. You've won an award for social entrepreneurship. Tell us a little bit about the work that you've mainly done in the area of water, kind of how you became a social entrepreneur. Why did you do that? How did you do that? How did you end up spending so much time in Africa?
Well, I was fortunate when I went to university. I went to St. Lawrence University in upstate New York, and there was a professor there from Somalia. His name is Ahmed Samatar, and he saw something in me. I still don't really know what. And he kind of threw me into northern Kenya. St. Lawrence has a program there. It's a really good program. And Ahmed he's kind of a generalist, maybe leans a bit towards agriculture, but I ended up on a water project. Up on the Ethiopian border. And if you can imagine what that looks like, it's a place called the Chalbi Desert. And the people who live there are known as the Gabra, and they migrate quite extensively, 12 to 15 times a year. So they're very mobile. And they move between Ethiopia and Kenya, and they don't really recognize either state. They kind of talk about what's going on down there in Kenya and what's going on up there in Ethiopia. They see themselves as quite independent. And, the work was fascinating. We were looking at a whole bunch of ways to strengthen their ability to migrate without depleting water resources, permanent water resources. So there's a lot of dams and reservoirs and things to keep them in non-permanent water sources for a little longer so the environment could regenerate. And I remember this one morning I got up. It was early. It was like 6:30, 7 in the morning. And there was a caravan of people crossing the desert. They're all girls and moms with camel. And they had huge water sacks, camel skin water sacks on the back of their camels. And we were talking, and it was hot. The wind's starting to blow, the sun's up. And I'll never forget it. There was this girl, and she was probably 12 or 13 years old. And she was angry. She was really angry. And she was angry about two things. She was basically saying, why have we stopped to talk to this Mzungu, this white guy? Because we got a long way to go. And if you looked across the desert, you had no idea where they came from and no idea where they were going. And the second thing that really struck me was she was basically saying, that's my mom, and I'm going to be doing this the rest of my life. And I was outraged by that. I was completely outraged by that. And so water and sanitation to me has always been a woman's issue. It's a girl's issue. If you care about those things, if you care about girls and women, then water and sanitation is kind of for you. And I ended up spending the next 20 years in Africa and another 10 back in the United States working on water and sanitation issues. You mentioned what you're talking about is the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. So we were honored. I was running an organization called Water for People in Denver, Colorado, and we had programs in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And we basically kind of blew up the way the sector operated. We basically said, we're actually getting nowhere. We're doing these little bitty projects all over the place. We're doing a project here, a project there. There's no real flow to it. And the sustainability is not very good. The monitoring is not very good. And frankly, if we were going to imagine a way to solve this problem, we wouldn't work like this at all. So we came up with a program called Everyone Forever, which is very simple. It's basically we identified 30 districts and cities around the world. So not a village, but like hundreds and thousands of villages within a government, kind of geographically defined government area. So there's a local government or city government. And we said the outcome of our work has to be that every family, every school, and every clinic got access to water and sanitation and never needed an international NGO ever again. And those are two things that are quite measurable. And so what we did is we unlocked Ministry of Finance money. We took very small amounts of philanthropic capital that we had. You know, everyone always talks about, oh, we need more money, we need more grant money, we need more money from USAID, blah, blah, blah. And we said, no, actually, there's a ton of money out there within ministries of finance that's not being utilized. So let's use our philanthropic capital. Let's get money flowing from the Ministry of Finance. Let's help districts and cities become good investments so they manage their money well, they implement effectively, they report on it. And let's kind of model what a world would look like where everyone has access to water and doesn't need external support again. People thought we were nuts. And you know, there was kind of patronizing comments about it, you know, this small NGO in Denver, who do you think you are? But then one district got full coverage verified by national government, then another district got full coverage, then all of a sudden all these districts started moving forward and mayors started to brag. You know, they basically said to other mayors, I'm solving a development problem and I'm accessing Ministry of Finance money. And once I finish with water and sanitation, I'm going to do Everyone Forever in education or agriculture or something like that. And I'm going to not only be the best mayor in this town, but I'm going to run for president someday. And it's amazing what a little competition does. So the Skoll Award was basically in recognition of our work for reimagining the way the water sector could operate by getting government more involved, getting government more financially involved, and using philanthropic capital as it should, as a catalyst, but not as the sole driver.
I'm really intrigued by some of the writing you've done, and you talk about rethinking hydro philanthropy. So I want to talk about that in a second. But when you refer to, just for clarification, when you refer to the way in which the water sector works, can you just be a little more specific? Because I mean, I've got visions in my head of like the technical side of things,
sure.
and kind of the technology of providing clean water and moving that water, delivering that water, and then obviously managing these relationships and creating coalitions using government and other resources, you know, to make this happen. When you say that these communities have full coverage, I mean, what exactly are we talking about when we talk about the water sector?
Yep.
You know, all the people that are involved, and then when we say when you pointed out water coverage, entire water coverage, what can you just clarify that for us?
Sure, it's a great question. So you know this story, like you know this girl. There's a girl in ratty clothes who, you know, has a bucket in her hand. She walks down a path. She misses school. She goes to this disgusting puddle at the bottom of a hill. She fills it up. She puts it on her head. She walks back, and she does that all day. And the family gets sick and all that. That's sort of the story of the water sector. So there are all these girls going and fetching water. What the water sector has never told or rarely tells is that girl was passing a hand pump or a tap put in by an NGO or a government agency or USAID or something like that. So the water sector is generally operated based on inputs. So you have a girl, you have a community without water, let's just put in infrastructure. And Africa, Asia, and Latin America are riddled with broken infrastructure. When I lived in Africa for, again, for about 20 years, I spent 70% of my time fixing failed water projects. And the reason it didn't work was because the problem is much more complicated. It's not just about putting in a hand pump and saying, voila, there you go, off and manage it. It's about building up supply chains around it. It's about building up financial responsibility and management around it. It's making sure the water quality and quantity is sufficient for the whole area. And it's about getting government to do its job. And so what we did was, instead of doing what every other organization was basically doing, is I'll pick a village and put in a project and, you know, cut a ribbon and tell a good story. We basically said, no, we're going to build the water ecosystem around not just this village, but every village within this district. We're going to track results for 10 years, which was unheard of at the time, because people tracked it just from implementation. And we're going to identify what are the things we did well that we, not just Water for People, but others, collectively did well to ensure that water flowed forever, again, without external support, and what are the things that didn't work so that we could constantly improve. And so the sector moved away from bitty projects by projects and kind of counting beneficiaries, counting the number of people who got access to a tap, to saying, well, how many people have access to a tap in 5 years? How many people have access to a tap in 10 years? And the requirements to get that to work are much more complicated. Just think about your water utility, right? Your water utility was built in Oklahoma how long ago? Decades ago, right? You expect water every day, right? You don't know how. You pay for it, but you don't know how. And you know if it busts or if there's a pipe break, it's probably on the news, but they fix it really fast. And so all the things around that utility that make water flow to your house every day are what the water sector has historically not done in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. They just put in a utility and hoped it worked. Does that make sense?
Absolutely makes sense. Thank you for that clarification. Now, so let's talk about the money side of things, because clearly these types of projects require resources, financial and human resources. Mm-hmm. You know, NGOs have often come under fire about how they go about spending these types of resources, earning the resources and spending the resources. But just tell us a little bit about what you've called hydrophilanthropy, which I presume is charitable giving or some sort of process of supporting these types of water projects. How should we rethink them, since that's basically the title of one of your projects?
So it's a funny story. I was basically sitting in Denver in 2007 or 2008, and I was crabby. I was like in a really bad mood. And so I did this stream of consciousness paper called Rethinking Hydrophilanthropy, which basically said a lot of things I'm saying now, is that we need to clarify who is financially responsible and what is the role of external aid. It can't be dominant. It has to tie in with other financial flows in the areas. We have to monitor long term. We have to get away from short termism to long term results. We have to move from inputs to outcomes and all of that. And it was kind of like it was like almost like a white paper. And I gave it to a couple of people on staff. They made really good comments. They helped me make it better. And then I literally shared it with like 10 people. And at the time, I never thought put it on the web or anything like that. I just shared it with 10 people. And it really took off. It's bizarre. And so now you can actually find that paper in classrooms across the US. It's so strange to me because, again, it came from real crabbiness. I was not in a super creative mood. I was kind of, you know, and basically we built Water for People to encapsulate the ideals of that paper. So it's all about long-term results, using philanthropy for catalytic purposes, not just to – we're never going to have enough money to solve it with philanthropy, so stop pretending. So how would you use it if you don't have enough money? How can you be creative? And it was all around that people seemed to grab onto, which was fun.
So are there opportunities? I love the story, by the way, that crabbiness leads to such a great...
It's a crabby paper.
But I mean, I think that probably happens a lot, is people get frustrated perhaps in that type of process, particularly when we talk about resources and raising funds to do these types of projects from people that don't have these kinds of problems and that see
these
problems as very, very far away. So how does that translate? I mean, do you see that, you know, these types of charitable activities have really kind of picked up, and that, you know, you see a better future given that we've been rethinking hydrophilanthropy?
Yeah, I think what's happened is, even though the debate among nonprofits is still around we need more money, we need more money, I think there's a growing recognition that show me you can leverage the funds you have and multiply them. And that's actually a more compelling story, frankly, to a donor. So if I say to you, I need $5 to help a girl, maybe you'll give me that. But if I say to you, I'm going to take your $5 and I'm going to blend it with government resources and other funding, and it's going to equal $50, and I'm going to be able to now, because of that money, I'm going to be able to now design more comprehensively and more thoughtfully so that actually I never have to ask you for money again, which one would you buy?
And that works.
And it does
obviously
work.
It works,
yeah. And I think what we did in a very humble way is we kind of modeled, you know, when I left Water for People about 2 years ago, we were about $18, $19 million a year. And we were leveraging way more than that from governments and all that stuff. And it didn't come through us. We just got money flowing, right? And so we were kind of questioning with our actions, you know, why do you need to be a $100 million organization? Why do you need to be a $400 million organization? You can actually do a lot with $10 to $20 million, which is not easy to raise, but it's a heck of a lot easier than $400 million. And so why didn't we reimagine the conversation and reimagine funding flows and create an environment where philanthropic capital unlocks other capital for greater impact?
Well, very quickly then, as we end, that's a great segue, I think, because you mentioned you left Water for People. Mm-hmm. You moved on to some other projects, the Wounded Warrior Project, now uh-huh. doing private consulting. But do these types of ideas transfer from one sector to another? And are you able to what you called hydrophilanthropy, now directed to some other area?
Yeah, it was really fun. I mean, part of the reason I jumped was, you know, this idea of everyone forever. It's being called different things, but it sort of took off, right? Different governments took it up. Different nonprofits took it up. And I actually was like, I wonder exactly the question you just asked. Like, could this apply somewhere else? And so I basically said, let's try it in the veteran community. So I joined Wounded Warrior Project, which, you know, does really interesting work. I know there's a lot of chatter about it, but it does really interesting work. And we basically did the same thing. We basically designed citywide initiatives that said, could you imagine a situation where every veteran and their family within the city of, you know, Norman or Oklahoma City or Houston gets the support services and care that they need and serves and contributes and kind of reshapes the city? Can you show not only how you unleash veterans in a new space, but can you also show how unleashing veterans changes and improves cities for good? And so it sort of got me thinking that, yeah, the principles are the same, even if I went from taps and toilets to veterans in the U.S. It's kind of fun.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ned, for being here today and sharing with us these stories. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ned Breslin. He just became the CEO of the Tennyson Center in Colorado, but has spent years working on water and sanitation issues in Africa. You can find more information, download this episode, and subscribe to our weekly podcast at kgou.org. Worldviews is part of a partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Sam Dupre produces the show. Katie Holland researches our interviews, which are edited by Brian Hardzinski, and Audra Burles writes our web content. For Jonathan Benjamin Alvarado, I'm Suzette Corlott.